This is week two of Frequently Asked Questions, and our subject today is, must I choose between faith and science? And I don't know the background you have with this, your science background, school, and things you might have wrestled with, but there's a perception that Christians are anti-science. And maybe we don't feel that way here. Maybe we do. I don't know. But is it really true that Christians are anti-science? Do we need to be? Do faith and science mix together, or are they like oil and water? Just to start off, I just want to throw up here on the screen the definition of science, so we're on the same page. Science is the state of knowing, knowledge as distinguished from ignorance or misunderstanding. So it's about knowledge. It's a knowledge or a system of knowledge covering general truths or the operation of general laws, especially as obtained and tested through the scientific method. This is science, okay? If you want it in simple words, science is observable, testable knowledge. That's what science is. So in science, you want to follow the evidence wherever it leads. That's science. So, you know, we talked about Psalm 19 already. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they display knowledge. There's knowledge in the heavens. It's communicated to us from God. So as we wrestle with this question, are science and faith incompatible? Some people think, yes, science and faith are incompatible. And you're going to hear some quotes from different scientists, atheists, atheistic evolutionists, and some of them really feel strongly about it. I put science up there. Let me put religion up there too, so we're kind of on the same page. Religion is a cause, a principle, or system of beliefs held to with ardor and faith. So religion is a system of beliefs. Science is studying knowledge. So how do they work together? Here's a quote by Richard Dawkins. This guy is he's a professor at Oxford. He's a biologist, and he is a strong critic of Christianity. He is a evangelist of atheistic evolution, and here's what he says. God is unnecessary. Science can explain nature without any help from supernatural causes like God. There's no need for a creator. All right, so he would say science and faith are absolutely incompatible. So we want to wrestle with this idea. Has science made it unnecessary for faith to exist? Have we figured everything out? Just in terms of thinking about scientists, not all scientists are atheists. And there was a study done 100 years ago, 1914, and I'm just going to read this from a journal I read. Swiss-American psychologist James Luba surveyed about 1,000 scientists in the United States in 1914 to ask about their views on God. Luba found the scientific community equally divided, with 42% saying they believe in a personal God and the same number saying they did not. More than 80 years later, Edward Larson, a historian of science, then teaching at the University of Georgia, recreated Luba's survey, asking the same number of scientists the same exact question. What do you think he found in 1996, 20 years ago? Do you think the balance has shifted 80 years from 1914? What do you think? Do you think there are more people that do not believe in God or do believe in God or about the same? Same? Less? The study showed it was actually the same. It's another 1,000 scientists, 40% believe in a personal God. 40% of scientists. Now, it's 20 years ago, but I'm thinking it's probably pretty close to the same today. Not all scientists are atheists. Not all scientists do not believe in God. A lot of them do. So there are a lot more scientists out there who believe in God than most people think. I mean, that surprised me. I don't know if that number surprises you. But it did surprise me. So I'm not an expert in science, okay? Let's just throw that out there. I'm not an expert in the sciences, so today you're going to hear from a former science teacher. Maybe you knew this, maybe you didn't, but this former science teacher is still passionate about science and has a very strong faith in our Creator God. His name is Rick Hadley. He's currently a German teacher at the middle school, but he taught science. So Rick, I'm going to ask you to come on up. He was planning on this, by the way. This is planned. But he taught high school. Surprise! You never know. Might be you next week. So, yeah, Rick was... Let's see if we can get some.
We're good.
You're good. Okay. Rick taught high school science. He taught in South Carolina.
North Carolina.
North. Before he moved back to PA. Taught biology, earth science, chemistry. So he was into a lot of the sciences. He was a biology major in college, earned a Bachelor of Science in psychology and biology, and they call that a psychobiology degree. So this guy's a psychobiologist.
Crazy biologist.
And he is going to... He's going to give us a little bit more than I could give you about science and faith and how they work together. So I'm just going to pray for this time that God would use it. Lord, I thank you for Rick. I thank you for his heart for you and his love for science and knowledge and study. And so, God, I pray that this time would be enlightening to us, that we look at some facts, some scientific evidence, and that it would strengthen our faith. In Jesus' name, amen. So, Rick, tell us a little bit about some of your personal background. Curious, which came first for you, science or faith?
Yeah, I've always liked science. I have an uncle on my dad's side who was actually a real actual rocket scientist. He was head of launch operations for NASA. I just always had a thing for science, but definitely my faith, I would have to say, came first. I hadn't heard much about evolution and all that. I hadn't been tested. That didn't come until college. But I did grow up in a Christian home. From the age of, I don't know as early as I could remember, I was going to Sunday school and learning about God. So I'll definitely say faith came first and a passion for science grew.
Okay. So in your journey then, has faith and science ever been in conflict for you?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, they have been.
Tell us more.
I went to Lebanon Valley College. It's a small liberal arts school, not too far from here. And every last one of the professors was, at least as far as I could tell, they were atheists or at best a theistic evolutionist. And so they at best would think that God got a ball rolling and then, you know, death and all that kind of took over and shaped what we are today. I'll explain a little more about that later. But I was completely unprepared for it, honestly. I never heard all that stuff, or, you know, it was watered down anyhow. And in high school, you know, you're with your friends, you're half listening to what teachers say, you think stuff's interesting. But I was really, like, front lines. These guys, if you were to, like, raise your hand and say, I believe in God, they would do their best to embarrass you or just say, get out and maybe come back next time because we don't have time for this nonsense. Basically. Yeah. And so a few times I would try and say things, but the best I could come up with at the time was, well, maybe God got the ball rolling and, you know, all these PhDs are telling me what is. And as an undergrad, I really didn't have a whole lot of ammunition or experience to really think about it from any kind of other perspective. So definitely did. And then a little personal note, my life and my actions definitely reflected not a Christian perspective, but I was acting more and more, I could tell, like someone who doesn't believe there is a God and, you know, just do what you want to do and all that. So they definitely went hand in hand with me.
So how did you get through that?
Yeah.
There was a transition, right?
There was. I went home. Like I said, my family's strong Christian background, and my brothers were into a guy named Kent Hovind. I don't know if anybody's heard of him. You can find him online. I actually realized years later that I had seen him at a church, the man, the myth, the legend, in flesh and blood at a church, and it didn't really occur to me, and I'd completely forgotten about that. But after watching the videos that my brother showed me, I remembered all this stuff, and he completely blows the evolution as it is an origin of species and replacing God out of the water. So my brothers were really key in bringing me back from the edge,
good,
so to speak.
Good. All right. Well, how would you answer the big question of the day? Must I choose between faith and science?
No. No, you must not. Science is objective. Science is based on observations and trying to test out hypotheses. So a hypothesis is just an idea, like an explanation for something, and you're supposed to test that. It takes, believe it or not, faith to believe that there's no God. So scientific community is a misnomer, really, because it's a faith community that believes that evidence shows that there's no God. Whereas the Christian community is faith, and we freely admit it, we have faith in God. It's all throughout the Bible, have faith. But it's not science that's at odds with either one. It's how you interpret the science and what your gut instinct and what your feelings are and beliefs are. So,
yeah, I think that's important that everybody has faith in something.
Right.
So we're going to explore some of that. So, but there's no denying that there is tension between the Christian faith and the scientific community. There's definitely tension. Some quotes, Dawkins again, he said, "You cannot be an intelligent scientific thinker and still hold religious beliefs. It is one or the other." Now, that's a faith statement, right? Like, he is very vehement about this. You can't be an intelligent scientific thinker and still hold religious beliefs. That's what he believes. There's a tension. But C.S. Lewis said something very different. Man became scientific because they expected law in nature. And they expected law in nature because they believed in a legislator, capital L. God is the legislator. The reason we are scientific is because God made us, and we knew that there were rules that he made that would be steady, that we could count on. So, but there's still this tension. There's still this tension in the community between science and faith. So why do you think that is?
It's, my opinion is it's faith's at war. You know, like we said, the atheists have faith in their science and their interpretations of it, and that there is no God, and that takes faith. You can't prove that. Proof is a word you really want to avoid. That was first week or so in science class that I was taught. You don't say prove. We don't prove things. We support them. Mm-hmm. We say evidence shows, right, or evidence suggests. But proof is something you really stay away from if you're a good scientist anyway and not fired up about your religious atheist beliefs. It's just... When people believe something and they have faith in something and someone else believes something else and has faith in something else, especially if they're complete opposites, you're going to wind up with tension. Mm. And it's not so much the science, because science is objective, science is what science is. It's we who interpret it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do we need another microphone? Just plug it in tighter. It might be loose. It's got a loose connection there. Should we switch them? Yeah. Which one you want? This one? You're rattling. It might not distract anybody else, but it distracts me. Let's see if we can untangle this. Yeah. There we go. Try that.
We'll see if that's any better. I'll hold it up like this.
It'll be better. Pinky's out.
Pinky's out.
All right. Tell us a little bit about something called naturalism. You and I talked a little bit about that. What is that?
Naturalism basically removes any kind of supernatural, man behind the curtain, sky fairies, whatever the scientific community wants to call it, from the equation. But that's not scientific, because remember, science is supposed to look at evidence and follow where it leads. If you're going into the process believing that there is no God and anything that would lead you that way has got to be wrong, well, you're not doing science anymore. Now you're trying to prove your beliefs as a faith.
Right.
Only the forces that act in the world are the ones that we have any business studying. They're the only ones that really actually exist. God can't possibly exist, so let's not even talk about that.
Mm-hmm. And how much do you think the science community has been influenced by naturalism?
So very much. I mean, if you go in, like I said, thinking, believing that there is no God, and that's a presupposition, and you don't even account for that, so like this could be showing, well, maybe there is a creator, maybe this is leading towards a conclusion that there is a God. Well, we're just going to ignore that or change it, or So it's no longer real science,
right?
At least not the conclusions.
Yeah. So the tension is not between faith and science, it's between faith in God and naturalism, which is faith in no God. That's the tension. So now we're going to get into the good stuff. This is the stuff I'm most excited about. And so the question, that this is going to be a long question right here. How is the science? No, not that one. Some Christians think science actually supports their faith. Do you think that's true? Rick's going to give us the answer is yes. Okay, I'm just going to say yes, but he's going to tell us
alert.
A lot of reasons. Yeah, spoiler. So I'm going to give you the clicker, and you can walk us through some
real reason I'm doing
things
it.
You know.
The clicker. This is fun now. All right. Okay. Click. There we go. Oh, these were your quotes, right? But Charles Darwin, you guys are familiar with who that is, right? Galapagos Island, the finches, the father of modern evolution. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down, but I can find no such case. Another spoiler alert, I think if Chuck Darwin were dropped into modern day right here, he would probably not believe that evolution shaped the Earth the way it did. So, okay. First of all, has anybody ever heard of macroevolution?
Yes.
Have you heard of microevolution? All right. Big difference, right? And this is real important to know whether you subscribe to atheistic evolution or not, because in no small part because a lot of people who are atheists don't know this. And you have to teach them about what they actually believe. Just saying. So microevolution, well, we'll just back up. Evolution driven by natural selection. Natural selection is based upon the fact that genes, right, the code for everything, how we look, how we smell, how we talk, they have little random mutations. Most of them are bad. Some of the mutations are good. Nature, so forces around us, select the ones that are good to be passed on. For example, if way back in the day we were all in Africa, right, and we're running around away from lions, and Bob is real slow. No offense, Bob.
Nope.
and I'm real fast. I get away from the lion. I get to make more babies. Bob gets to be dinner for the lion. No more babies for Bob. Bob's slow genes didn't get passed on. Mine did, right? Nature's selecting the genes that are going to get passed on. This is observable. This is good science, right? This actually happens. Dogs, right? We're the force driving it. Poodles didn't exist thousands, whatever years ago. Man-made poodles. Right? Why? I don't know. They look funny. But man also made Rottweilers, which are pretty cool. So so we got, where's my little, there it is. Yes. Beneficial, right? They help the organism survive. Therefore, they get passed on. Nature selects which ones. So either you get eaten and your genes don't pass on, or you get to go make more babies. Woo! And your genes get passed on. Good science. It's the interpretation. Remember the faith part that comes into play. And this is all accounted for in the Bible. Here, Genesis 1:24, and God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds. I made that bold and underlined and also italic. The livestock, the creatures that move along the ground, the wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. So the Bible talks about kinds, right? You can have variation within the different kinds, so cats can look different ways. And cats today didn't look the same as they did when God created whatever that first cat was, right? But it was still a cat, right? The leap of faith is that you think that genes are fancy and magical enough to create new kinds. So there was a little cell, like a little protist floating around in the muck, right, way back in the day, billions of years ago. And billion years ago later, here we are, right? People. So protist, people. Yeah. Leap of faith. With me so far? Excellent. Excellent. You guys are smart. All right. Here's a good example of how evolutionists are able to hold on to these beliefs. Because remember, these are not dumb people. These are people with PhDs. They're smart. They've been doing this for years and years. This is a euglena, a little protist type thing, right? It's got chloroplast. It's making its own energy like a plant. And here's an eye spot, right? It doesn't look like your eye or my eye. So it seems kind of fancy and magical that this eye spot could, over billions of years, become an eyeball. They've actually got this kind of wrapped up in a neat little package where it is possible. Say this euglena here has an eye spot and another one doesn't. They need light to make energy, so it's going to move towards the light because it's got an eye spot. One that doesn't have the eye spot, right, it can't detect the light, it's not going to know, so it's not going to have as much energy, it's not going to reproduce as well, it will probably die off, right? And then say this one had more little photoreceptors than the next euglena. Well, it can see a little better, so it's going to survive better, and then over years and years, you get like a little mutation where now the thing can see color. Well, that's an advantage too, right? So, and disclaimer here, mostly because I lost most of my points this morning, I did a bad job communicating with my wife, so I'm going to give you a warning here. If you don't like eyes, look away. Be a whole bunch of eyes staring right back at you. I got you, baby. Don't be scared. Boom. So you can get all these different kinds of eyes, right? You got people eye right there. You got a chameleon eye. You got like a puma eye. You got spider eyes. It's real gross and creepy. They have 8 of them. Yuck. But you can see where it's successive little changes, the things that are helping this eye become more fancy are selected for, right? Takes a little faith, but there it is. Here's where it breaks down. It's called irreducible complexity. You guys heard that? All right. Irreducible, you can't make it any simpler, complexity, something that's fancy and complex. This is, if you go back here, wait for it. Use my little fancy laser pointer. That's the flagellum, right? Protists use them to whip around, and they go places with them. That's a rotary engine. What is the point of having bushings, or the point of having a U-joint, or a stator, C-rings, rotor? What would any of those things do by themselves? How can you reduce that to something that doesn't do what that does and still provide a benefit? It can't, right? The only thing that makes sense is that this was all there at the start, right? You can't just have an engine, right? And there it is. Something had to create that. Make sense? Right. This is where Charles Darwin said that even if one little thing that can't be explained by little bitty changes, the whole system breaks down. And it has. All right. This right here is real dangerous, if you ask me. I had to teach it when I was down in North Carolina. Uniformitarianism. It's a major assumption, and this is off of a website that didn't have any affiliation with Christian Science or anything like that. Major assumption, events in the past occurred the same as they do today, right? So basically, the way it looks outside today is the way it looked outside 1,000, 100,000, million, 2 million, 10 billion, whatever years ago, right? Well, the Bible, I don't know if you knew this, talks about waters above the firmament and below the firmament, right? So firmament being land. It's down here. God made the firmament, the land, divided the waters which were under from the waters which were above. Some people say that's clouds. Later on, there was a flood. I don't know if you knew that, right? Noah and the ark and all that junk. The water came down from the firmament and up from below the firmament, right? So the Bible's saying that it's not always been the same, right? That there was a big event about 4,400 years ago called the flood, and that changed the game. Right? By the way, I don't have a slide for this, but I think it's real interesting. Every major culture in the world has a flood myth, and they're eerily similar. There are people getting onto a big boat, right? People wading out and riding the waves, and they land on a mountain, and then they repopulate the earth. It's in every single one of them, all of them. And I don't know how you explain that away, honestly. Something happened. Mm-hmm. And if you keep up with science, you'll eventually just keep seeing stuff that keeps backing up the Bible, even though, amazingly, the Bible hasn't changed, right, mm-hmm. since it was assembled. Science keeps changing. But there is more water, listen, more water under the surface of the earth than in all the oceans combined. Almost like there was enough to cover the earth with water. Mm-hmm. Weird. I don't know. Didn't see that coming, right? So there it is, and that's here's like an ocean, right? And then here's all that water underneath. I don't know, man. I don't know. Polystrate fossils, anybody ever heard of those? Yeah, get some. This is a tree. Millions of years, this tree was just standing there waiting to be buried. I don't buy it. What about you, right? Trees, as far as I know, they'll decay and rot away and stuff. I've seen it happen, right? It doesn't take millions of years. Mm-hmm. So if you ask me, this tree was down here in the bedrock. It was in the firmament, and then a flood came and buried all that stuff on top. And these processes don't have to take millions and millions of years. There's a tree, right? I like this one. 80-foot Apatosaurus had nostrils about the same size, as a horse, which would require much more oxygen than we have in the atmosphere today. So picture a horse. Right? They're biggish. Nostrils, right? Picture an 80-foot, 8-story tall animal with nostrils that big. It would light its face on fire trying to suck air in to get enough oxygen into its lungs. Right? It wouldn't be able to do it. Mm-hmm. So the thought is, back when the water was above and also below, that there was more oxygen. That it was like a hyperbaric chamber. They're just discovering this now, too. A lot of athletes will go into hyperbaric chambers after competing or sometimes before, and you feel like you can run forever because mm-hmm. in this old dying, decaying world, we don't have enough oxygen like we used to, like God had at the start. It's changed, right? And that explains dinosaurs and where they went, right? You can't get as big. Lizards grow their entire lives. Do you guys know that? So if things had oxygen like they needed and they could grow real big, you could have dinosaurs, right? Mm. All right. Vestigial structures. It's bringing back like real sour memories to anybody in biology class. Right? Runaway screaming. That's okay. Evolutionary leftovers, right? A famous one is the coccyx, right? It's not a dirty word. It's down here. They said it was like a tailbone, right? Your tailbone that used to be a tail attached to it. There's another one I'll show you. I'll show you that one right now, actually. The whale, right? So you got this pelvic bone, pubic bone, right? And what? I have to laugh a little bit. They believe, evolutionists who take God out of the picture, believe that this was what the whale was walking around on, that had legs, right? That it was out there on land walking around and then decided to go back in the ocean for whatever reason, and nature selected the legs to disappear, and there you have a whale, right? Well, actually, if any kids in here and they don't understand stuff yet, maybe cover their ears, that's attached to the penis of the whale. So it has nothing to do with walking around on dopey little goofy comic legs out on land, but everything to do with making more whales, right? And it's right there. I found both of these online on websites that have no affiliation with Christian Science or anything like that. But that right there actually has a function. It's not leftover, right? Another one here. Here's your coccyx, right? Your tailbone. And it is, they claim that it used to be a tail, right? And I don't know about you, but I could sure go for a tail. That'd be sweet. Groceries, you're walking in the house, whoop, there's the door, right? Don't have tails anymore. Why would that go away? I want that, right? But actually, there's a scientific word is your poop chute, right? It's your anus and your colon and stuff. And if you remove that, you'll be pooing big old. It's going to be pretty. Right? You're not going to be able to hold on to the poos. It's going to come out. I know a guy, actually Ken Hovind, who has a standing offer to anyone who wants to have their coccyx removed. He'll pay for it. No takers. Go figure. I don't know, man. What are you going to do? All right. Astronomy. I love astronomy. It was my favorite course that I ever took as far as sciences go. And these are some fancy words, but I'm going to kind of front load you here, and we'll get to the point after a few minutes. Orbit eccentricity. It's fancy, right? All it means is that we don't go around the sun in a perfect circle, right? The more eccentric it is, the more it looks like an oval over here, right? So here's your sun, or it could be Earth and the moon, whatever. But they're going around in a perfect circle. That's zero, and then a little funny there, you know, five, and then you got like an oval that's going around like Halley's Comet or something, right? They go real dopey around the sun, and that's a huge one. Orbit eccentricity, okay? And then you have here orbital inclination. It's basically, if you think about the sun being in the middle of a trampoline, right? Are the other planets on the trampoline too, or are they a little above the trampoline? Make sense? Okay, so as we're going around the sun, we're a little off-center and we're a little tilted. Okay. At the start of the universe, they say that there was the Big Bang, right? Everything in the universe was in a spot like about this big, and they'll, in science textbooks, say it's about the size of a period on this page, and kids are looking at it like, wow, all my stuff was in there, that's crazy. Yes, it is. And it was all spinning real fast, and it was real hot, right? If you've ever been on a merry-go-round, right, you spin the kids around, and if you were to keep spinning and spin them faster and faster and faster, and kids start flying off, they spin the same way that the merry-go-round was spinning. That's called a conservation of angular momentum, right? All kinds of fancy science, but just have it in your head that if you're spinning and you come off of the thing that's spinning, the kids would be flipping around counterclockwise or whatever, right? Okay. Now, this is odd, because if things were spinning around all in the same direction and then they fly off in a nanosecond, they should all be going still the same direction, right? Just like the kids flying off the merry-go-round, okay? We have a planet aptly named, I call it Uranus now, it used to be Uranus, and that's funny because it's on its side, kind of showing you its, well, you know. There's Uranus on its side, right? If it were spinning out like this, how did it wind up going like that? Well, that's weird. Also, Venus rotates the opposite direction of the other planets. So what happened there? Also, 6 out of the 63 moons, and they've discovered more, so I'm sure the number's a little different, but they rotate the opposite direction just like Venus. Well, how do you account for that? That doesn't make any sense, right? Evolution as an atheistic theory would break down, right? What they've come up with is, and tell me if this makes sense, if it could be plausible, that space junk and debris and stuff hit Uranus and knocked it over onto its side, right? Or space debris hit Venus and flipped it all the way around, and now it's like upside down, right? And same thing for the moons, I would assume, right? Now just take a step back. Is that plausible? Is that possible? I can see you. Mm-hmm. It's possible. It is possible. But what would you expect? Go back over here. What would you expect? Uranus, huge. Got creamed. It's on its side now. Would you expect it to be real circular? Or would you expect it to be elongated? Would you expect it to be right there with the rest of the planets? Or would you expect it to be tilted up from the impact? You expect it to look funny other ways too, right? Same thing with Venus and the other planets, or the moons. The problem for atheistic evolution is, ta-da, Uranus, second best centered. So, right there on the plane. Second best. There are 8 official planets. Pluto's real funny, right? And they don't count it a planet anymore. But the other planets are more off, right? They're not as close as Uranus is. And it's also very ordinary with its orbital eccentricity. By the way, second best centered on the orbital plane. Which one do you think is the best centered on the orbital plane? Third rock from the sun, baby. That's where the life is. I don't know. It's all just happenstance, though. Venus, fairly displaced from the orbital plane. So it's tilted up a little bit. Not the most, but a little bit. Mercury is ridiculous. And then Venus is the least eccentric. Least eccentric. It's almost a perfect circle going around the sun. And it was creamed so many times that now it's upside down. Right? It just doesn't hold water. 10% of the moons in the solar system rotate backwards, right? That's not enough where this is a normal occurrence, but it's also not so rare that, oh, it happened once, whatever. To me, this speaks to God, right? He created this stuff, and he's not trying to trick us. He put just enough of them in there where this is an anomaly, and there's a reason for it, and it really doesn't make sense that the things that the evolutionists were coming up with. Mm. I've said a lot of stuff. Do you guys have any questions? I'm kind of limited here. I can't come out and smack you, but smack you. All right, good enough. New discoveries. Like I said, if you keep up with science, you're going to keep finding stuff where the scientist minds get a little blown and they got to backpedal because, remember, they're naturalists and they don't believe that there's a God and there can't possibly be a God, so anything that shows that there might be a God has got to be wrong somehow, or we got to find an explanation for it that doesn't involve God. One that I really like is dark matter. Have you heard that? They talk about it on the Big Bang Theory pretty frequently. Right? Bible talks about beings that can go in between dimensions, and you see them now, and then you don't, and, oh, that's just sky fairy stuff, right? That's real fancy, right? Well, dark matter, from their calculations, from what they understand, is about half of the matter in the known universe. Half of what's out there we can't even see. In this room right now, everything you see is actually only half of what's in this room. Let that sink in. That allows all kinds of room for angels and demons and things to be working behind a curtain, whatever, right? I think that's fascinating. And laws of quantum mechanics. That's a little too fancy for even me. We do have a video. Hopefully this one works.
Hopefully this one works.
And he'll introduce himself and all that. But he's gonna go through modern discoveries and how the Big Bang Theory and all that has changed a little in their understanding of the universe and a few new discoveries. And he's actually going to, remember, don't use the word prove, but the evidence definitely leads to a belief in a creator God. I just hit the next.
I'll try.
Hit the next.
My name is Gerald Schroeder. Thank God, a strong science background from MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, bachelor's, master's, PhD, 7 years in the physics staff, seen a whole range of atomic bombs detonated, moved to Israel, met my wife, Barbara Sofer, a great writer, and then teach Torah and science. So luckily, I'm lucky that I have the two that come together. And one of the questions that I'm asked as a scientist is, how can a scientist really believe that there's something that we refer to usually as God? You know, is this metaphysical whatever acting in the world or producing the world? And the irony is, the question's really a non-starter. Science has, in fact, discovered God. And you can talk to the hardline atheists, and they will say, it looks like science has indeed discovered God. And how would that be? Well, if you take the trouble of going to the web and they're typing WMAP, the initials for a satellite, it's a diagram that shows the development of the universe from the creation over time. It's a timeline. Every word on that diagram comes from the NASA site. It is the condensed knowledge of the scientific community of how the universe created and how it got to where we are today. Each of the lines, the vertical lines, is another billion years. Okay, you start from a burst of energy at the extreme left side of the diagram, and you end up at the far end with the oval. The oval is to indicate expansion in all directions. Of course, because it's a timeline, we can't show that on a single piece of paper. We see here, most amazingly, that on the extreme left edge, it shows a beginning to the universe. Now, go back less than 50 years. If I were teaching that at Tech, a person could lose tenure. saying that there was a creation of the universe. It sounds like it's Bible, because less than 50 years ago, the overwhelming scientific opinion was the universe is eternal. There was never a beginning. The Bible is wrong from the very first sentence. And then we discovered, suddenly, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, the Bell Labs in New Jersey, the northeast of the U.S., discovered the echo of the Big Bang, the energy left over, which George Gamow, 60 years ago, predicted that if there had been a universe created hot and small, it would have exploded, and the energy would get more and more dilute. And Penzias and Wilson, these Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, discover this energy that had been predicted overnight. The Bible got it right. There was a beginning to the universe. Now, the black in the diagram is nothing. It's not a vacuum. Vacuums are within that diagram, within that cone of expansion. Vacuums are empty space, and space is something. The black of the paper around the diagram is nothing. It doesn't fit in our human brain, because humans think in a box made of time, space, and matter / energy. No human, as clever as they might be, as expansive as they might be, thinks out of that box. So when we say outside that diagram is nothing, we can use the words, but we can't conceive of nothing. It doesn't fit in the human brain. How are we going to have this idea, is there a God or not? Notice that the creation force isn't a three-letter word, G-O-D. If you look at the words carefully, it's a quantum fluctuations. That understanding was first brought down by Ed Tryon, brilliant human being, in the journal Nature almost 40 years ago. The universe allows creation of something from nothing, provided you have the laws of nature, the quantum fluctuation. Tryon realized, and he published in the journal Nature, one of the two leading peer-reviewed journals in the world, that you can create something from absolute nothing, provided you've got the laws of nature, quantum physics and the laws of relativity. In other words, the laws of nature. So look what science has discovered. We can create the universe from absolute nothing, provided we have the forces of nature. Now, the laws of nature, the forces of nature aren't physical. They act on the physical. So if they create the universe, that means they predate the universe. So now we have a set of forces, we call them the laws of nature, that are not physical, that are able to act on the physical. They create the physical from absolute nothing. And they predate the universe, which means they predate our understanding of time. Put that together, and it sounds very familiar. If you haven't noticed it, that's the biblical definition of God. There's only one nuance that's left hanging. We can talk about it another time, perhaps. Is that which created the universe, those forces, active in the universe? But up to that point, science says, you are correct. The definition of the biblical God is predates time, outside of time. God is not a physical being, is a force, and it creates the universe. You'll notice that the opening chapter of Genesis, the only name for God is Elohim, God as manifest in the universe. Science has indeed discovered the biblical God. Well, we just need one part left, crucial. That which created the universe is also active in the universe itself. The very fact that you're watching this now pretty much establishes that point.
How cool is that video? Do you guys have any questions about it? When he puts those four parts up there, I go into Scripture where God says, I am the Word. The Word, the laws, right? The laws that govern everything. The fact that there was no beginning or end to them, and they just discovered that there was a beginning to what we have, but not to the laws of nature, the Alpha and the Omega, beginning and the end, right? It's all right there. And the Bible hasn't changed.
Yeah.
The only thing that's changed is scientists are discovering new stuff and new ways of looking at it. And to me, it all leads straight back to what God said. So how about that stuff?
Might need to watch that one again, right?
Yeah.
Not today, but if you want to watch it again, you can.
I've seen it probably about 20 times. So every time. Cool. Were there any questions? I don't know how much time do we have.
A little bit.
Get you out of here by like 5, 6 tomorrow morning.
Well, that's a lot of stuff. Like, he started small with those little tiny single cell beings all the way up to the universe. And those are a lot of different evidences for God designing that and creating it. Is there anything else that kind of leads you to reject naturalism?
Yeah. I got some slides.
Okay.
The morality, right? Where does morality come from? It doesn't make sense that anybody would want to stick their neck out to save someone else's life and put their own life in peril, right, if we're just sacks of genes that are worried about passing on our own genes to the next generation. I even had a professor who had a little formula. My wife had him too, Dr. Cooley, for how likely someone is to go save someone who's dying. And he, if I remember right, he wasn't even particularly concerned with your own life being at risk, just like letting somebody die, right? So if somebody's like drowning and you have a pole and you can pull them out, well, should I, shouldn't I, am I weighing this out, right? You're pretty likely, if it's your own kid, right, because those are your genes passed on and that's your direct line. If it's like your niece or nephew, he had a whole percentage thing worked out, you're 50% likely to save that person, right? Your parents, nah, right? They already passed their genes on. Not worried about them, right? To me, this is real sick. You're reducing people's lives down to a simple formula with percentages attached to them, right? Like a complete stranger, you're not likely to. You're not, right? And that's not the way it is, right? There's something in us, I believe, that God imprinted us with his desire to love others, and you would save someone if you could, right? I mean, it's just, so. Anyway, that school of thought, it really only leads one place. And before I show you, when did death come into the earth according to the Bible? Anybody? Go for it. After creation, right? We were here, we were in the garden, eating the fruit, and then disobedience and sin enters, and now death, right? Not at the start. With evolution, you remember any of what I said? When did death come into the picture with relation to mankind? See your head shaking. I'd come out there if I could. At the beginning, before man was even here. So with the one, God shaped man, created man, and death came in, and that's unpleasant, and God's going to save us from it. And the other, the God is death. Death drives us. We are here because of death. Right? And here's a great illustration of it. Creation, right? Man's actions. Now there's death. With atheistic evolution, you got primitive stuff, you know, protists and things, and a lot of stuff has to die for those genes that aren't so great to make way for the genes that were randomly mutated and are so great. So man is here because of suffering, disease, bloodshed, death, meteors, volcanoes. Things have to die for us to get here. Well, if kids are believing this, right, truly believing this, and they don't have a strong faith background in Christ or in the Bible, or I mean, it could be a different religion too. We don't have to really just hone in on Christianity. But if you're truly believing that, and I've had kids come up to me, you get the nihilist thoughts. Well, if we're all just a colossal accident and it's death that's driving us here, well, then I should just commit suicide, right? Well, by that logic, is that really so bad? You suffer here, right? Created by death. Death is king over all, right? Just take your genes out of the population so the rest of us can have better genes, right? Get into some sick stuff. I'll just read these because online you don't see it, right? Online, you don't see
right,
the...
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. I'll just read them. I don't really think I have to say too much about most of them. Arthur C. Clarke, maybe those nihilist philosophers are right. Maybe this is all we can expect of the universe, a relentless crushing of life and spirit, because the equilibrium state of the cosmos is death. Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood. Yay, Planned Parenthood. The most merciful thing that a large family does to one of its infant members is to kill it. Make space. Richard Dawkins, Nate had a quote from him up there before, militant atheist, biologist. Somebody posted, this lady here had a question for him on his Twitter account. I honestly don't know what I would do if I were pregnant with a kid with Down syndrome. Real ethical dilemma. Richard Dawkins' response, abort it and try again. It would be immoral to bring it into the world if you have the choice. Just kill it. Start over. Bad genes. Hitler, this cheery fellow, he wrote a book called Mein Kampf, right? A lot of people bought into it, started a whole war, millions of deaths, genocide. He wrote in there, in Mein Kampf, in that book, by leaving the process of procreation unchecked and by submitting to the individual to the hardest preparatory tests in life, meaning leave them go, do not help, they survive, they got good genes, if they don't, they got bad genes, they should have been out of the pool anyhow, right? Nature selects the best from an abundance of single elements and stamps them as fit to live and carry on the conservation of the species. Right? Actually, we just found this out while we were watching, is it Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or Willy Wonka? Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the one with Gene Wilder. They filmed that movie in Germany, and they had to go throughout the world to find little people to act as the Oompa Loompas because through the genocide, the ethnic cleansing that they did, they murdered so many of the dwarves that there weren't enough in Germany to fill the roles in the movie. Mm. This is what it leads to. This is what evolution as an atheistic engine leads you to believe. Mm. He's not unique. Hitler was not unique. Time between mass shootings, 1982, you can see every few years, you know, two together there, Louis Massacre, and as you keep going, they're just right on top of each other, and they're getting worse, right? Shooting children up in Connecticut. If you have no respect for life, and we're all just here because of death anyway, why would kids put value on each other's lives, right? Tolstoy, Leo, the only absolute knowledge attainable by man is that life is meaningless. Cute. Save the planet. Kill yourself. You first, right? That's what I say. But if you truly buy into the fact that death has shaped us, well, then you're going to have to use death to make us better. A lot of people are going to have to die of this Übermensch, this superhuman race that all kinds of different, Pol Pot comes to mind, Hitler, Stalin, they murdered millions, right? Mm. This is where it leads. I believe that was my last one, right? Yeah.
Wow, huh? The direction that morality goes with that belief is crazy. Rick, thank you. Thank you. Anybody have any questions before he steps down? It's a lot to think about, right? You can go online and catch that again if you need to review any of that. But there are really a lot of questions that the naturalistic view of the world cannot answer. A lot of the questions about meaning, some of the biggest questions of life, where did we come from? What went wrong? What's the solution? These are questions of faith. You can't prove the end of it. So there's faith. There has to be faith in one thing or another. Did God do it or did it just happen by accident? So thankfully, the Bible gives us answers. We have answers. And science keeps confirming the Bible over and over where it thinks it's got it wrong. So our purpose today isn't just to determine which point of view we like the best. You know, the morality, obviously, our view is better. It's not about what do we like the best, but to honestly examine the facts. That's what science does. So we wanted to give you a chance to do that, to follow the evidence wherever it leads. Obviously, we have a point of view we're starting from, and so do they, but we want to look at the evidence. So hopefully you'll think about that again and continue to think about it. But even the scientists are saying the more we understand our universe, the more convinced we are that something started it. It didn't just happen. And I want to give you, I think this is just one more quote here, John Horgan in Scientific American. He said, "Science and religion converge in one important way. The more scientists investigate our origins, the more improbable our existence seems. If you define a miracle as an infinitely improbable event, then our existence, you might say, is a miracle." Anybody agree with that? Our existence is a miracle. This guy is not a believer. He does not believe in God at all. In the end of his article, this is what he says, just so you see his perspective. "I don't have faith in God, but I do have faith in humanity. Somehow this miracle happened. Humanity did not make that miracle happen. What did?" He doesn't know, but he believes it. So I would suggest the evidence overwhelmingly leads to divine design, as Rick just showed with multiple examples. So if that's the reality, if that's where the evidence leads and scientists follow the evidence wherever it goes, why are there so many people who refuse to believe that there's a designer? Why is that? And I believe that the book of Romans actually answers that question. There's a key in there. So I'm going to show you just quickly Romans chapter 1. If you want to look at it, you can look it up. But just want to show you a couple of verses as Paul is talking to the believers in Rome way back when. He says this: "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them." How did God make plain himself? since the creation of the world. God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. God has clearly revealed himself to us in the stars and in the protists. He's clearly revealed himself. But they suppressed the truth. Although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile. Their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like a mortal human being, birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served created things rather than the Creator, who's forever praised. This is what's happening in the scientific community. The naturalistic view exchanges the truth about God for a lie, and they worship created things. And there's worship going on in the scientific community of the created, not the Creator. And the big thing that Paul is pointing out, why does this happen? Because people suppress the truth. The evidence is overwhelming. It's all around you. But people suppress the truth. They put it down. And I do have a couple of evidences how scientists are suppressing the truth. They intentionally are pushing down the truth. And just some staggering quotes that show their presupposition, their starting point. They cannot accept God. Richard Dawkins: even if there were no actual evidence in favor of the Darwinian theory, we should still be justified in preferring it over all rival theories. Really? How about this? S.C. Todd, biologist at Kansas State University: even if all the data points to an intelligent designer, such a hypothesis is excluded from science because it's not naturalistic. Hello? That's good science, right? Richard Lewontin, a evolutionary biologist and geneticist: our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. We cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Do you smell suppressing the truth? Keep God out no matter what. And one more. When we see such intricate symmetry, and he's talking about the AIDS virus in this article, the symmetry of the AIDS virus, our brains automatically assume there was an inventor. Overcoming that instinct took centuries. The symmetry is all around us. But if you want to overcome that instinct, that takes a long time to believe that there was no designer behind it. Suppressing the truth has been happening for a long time. There's evidence, it's clear evidence. Why do people suppress the truth? What's the result? If they have to accept that there's a God, then they have to accept that there's going to be some accountability, that we're going to stand before that God. And I think that's a big deal. Not everybody who's a scientist, not everybody who's an atheist feels that way necessarily, because the culture's been pushing us along in that direction for so long. Kids in school, they just accept it as fact. That's what it is. But behind it, there's a desire to hide the truth, to suppress the truth, because we don't want to stand before God. So let's imagine him away. But there is a God, and he's revealed himself in creation. We have good news to that. People don't want to stand before God, but we have the way to stand before God and not be afraid. Because the God who made this planet came to this planet and walked this earth. God sent Jesus to live among us, to reveal himself in another way, not just in the stars, but in flesh. We mess things up, right? Death came because of us, our brokenness. We caused the problems. And God sent Jesus to fix it. And he fixed the problem in our hearts by Jesus dying on the cross. We can be forgiven. We can be made right with this God who made incredible, amazing, astounding, whether it's microscopically small or ginormous, he wants to be close to us, and he revealed that to us through Jesus. And Jesus came to fix what's broken. And we know from Scripture he's going to come again, and he's going to ultimately fix. I'm close to God again. Most of you are close to God again. We didn't start that way. But this is what Jesus did, and he's going to fix the broken earth we live in too, which is, it's hard to fathom and imagine what that's going to be like. But that stuff, that's beyond science. science is great. Science is amazing, and it can really help us. There's a lot of fascinating stuff to discover. But some things can't be tested. Some things can't be proven. They have to be taken by faith. So every person has to ultimately choose. Everybody's got to choose. Did God do it, or did nature do it? If God did it, there's some implications. Thank God that he sent Jesus to help us with our problem. We believe in a God who's the mastermind behind everything that exists. The evidence points to that. It supports that. And we also believe the intelligent designer revealed himself to us in creation, in the Bible, and in Jesus Christ. So in that video, he said, we've got to, okay, so it started from God, but is he involved? He is. He is. That's what we believe, right? We're on the same page here. There's a lot of people that we talk to who don't believe that. God is so distant, but he's not. He's here. And so as you interact with people, maybe you can interact in a more intelligent way as you consider some of these things, as you pick Rick's brain later and ask him more questions. Maybe you need to bring Rick along and meet one of your friends and you guys can have an intelligent conversation. He's up for it. Rick, are there any next steps that you would want us to, if we want to take this further? Trapped you.
Nice. That was wise. Mm-hmm. On the back there, my next step, the first one, nice and easy, go for a hike, marvel at the science behind God's handiwork. We could all do that, right? Every once in a while, I kind of get caught up in it. Like, even just think about a tree. There are millions of trees in the world, probably billions, right? And it's just kind of commonplace in every day when you're not thinking about it. But they have all kinds of different differentiated cells that take food up, that take water up, that take food down, that take water down. There's all kinds of chemical stuff happening in the roots. They have leaves that can open and close themselves, right? You have photosynthesis happening, the creation of sugars and things that we can use as energy from sunlight, oxygen, water. It's ridiculous, right? All those things are just completely built in, and there are billions of them out there, and it seems every day and commonplace, but even in a tree, trillions of cells all working in perfect unison. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. Dig deeper, check out a Kent Hovind video. He's great. He's real snarky, so that's your kind of thing, like dry kind of. He's a little rude sometimes almost, but in a good way, right? Kent Hovind, Creation Seminar. He's got a whole bunch of them. They're typically long. But even if you just watch for like 10, 15 minutes, you can get a lot of great stuff. And he was really part of what pulled me back from that edge I was talking about when I really didn't have anybody to help me, anybody talking to me about how God actually could have and how science actually does back God up. Also, talk to an atheist. This may be like a second or third or fourth step down the road for some of us about creation, how science has actually supported the Bible just as much, if not more, than evolution. People get pretty fired up about this stuff, and even still sometimes, like I was up about 1 o'clock actually the past two nights. I'm looking forward to going to sleep in a reasonable time tonight, but this stuff gets me fired up. And I just watched a whole bunch of videos, and some of them you'll get links on YouTube, and you can go from one to another, and you'll find some from atheists and the comments. The way people are so ugly to each other on Facebook and all is real kind of disheartening. But you look through those, and it still gets me fired up, and you got to take some deep breaths, and it's going to be okay, and you know, you don't want to just go in guns blazing because we do want to lead people to Christ. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so I'd say definitely educate yourself first, marvel at it, and use our feet.
All right.
Talk to somebody.
Thank you, Rick. Why don't you just take the next minute just to kind of sit and process some of the stuff we've thought about. Think about, okay, what does God want me to do next with this?